Hey, Brian Beeler here. Thanks for tuning into the Storage View podcast. This week, I've got Sean Myers on the podcast. He's the field CTO at Tintree. Tintree's been around, as he reminds me, which makes me feel ridiculously old, for, gosh, about 10 years at this point. And they were part of the crew that included Nimble, Tagile, and others that were trying to be disruptive and were disruptive at the time with hybrid flash arrays. So they were some of the first to add flash to their arrays and beat the big boys, HP, Dell, EMC, IBM to the punch, and were really good at bringing new features and new capabilities to the market. Back then, it was great virtualization, integration, and ease of management. And today, as we'll talk about, it's SQL Server integration. So if you're a storage admin, virtualization admin, SQL Server application person, I think you're really going to like this. And this is a fun conversation geared a little bit more towards the practitioner. So tune in and let's bring Sean in. Joining us on the podcast today, we've got Sean Myers, field CTO at Tintree by DDN. Sean, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. And thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, we're glad to do it. What exactly is a field CTO anyway?
Well, basically, I work for the office of the CTO, but most of my time I spend talking to more C-level people, and I think it's kind of just to give a little more gravitas to the title as the people I interface with.
And those people appreciate gravitas?
I hope so.
And speaking of field, you're really in the field. You're in Omaha. You're literally in the field.
That's correct. My subdivision is surrounded by cornfields.
Is it like the Field of Dreams? Is it the equivalent?
It's kind of close. Funny story, actually, Field of Dreams was actually, they contracted with my uncle's farm to actually film it on his farm. Then they found another farm next door and filmed it at his farm. So my uncle didn't get it, but a lot of my aunts and uncles and cousins are actually in the stands during that movie.
Well, that's somewhat reassuring, but they could have been cinematic heroes, and now they're just they're extras in the film.
Exactly. They could have had the farmhouse my mom grew up in was going to be the farmhouse, but again, they decided, no, this one's even prettier or more rustic, It's the more rustic Iowa look, and they see the one next door, and so it went to that one instead of the one my mom grew up in.
So that's pretty amazing. Did they at least get to meet Ray Liotta and Costner and crew?
The stories vary between aunt and uncle and cousin kind of stuff, but yeah, so they all hung out. They raved and raved about the catering. So when they're being extras, they didn't get paid a lot, but they ate very, very well.
Yeah, they got the craft services kind of meals and such.
Exactly.
So that's pretty cool. It's sort of bad luck, but at least they got a good story out of it. Do you have a better luck story? What's your best luck story?
Meeting my wife, I guess, just because she'll probably watch it someday. I don't know. I don't know if I have any great stories of best of luck.
Mine, I was thinking about it today because I was listening to another podcast where they were talking about luck, and I had to think really hard, just like the exercise you just went through of what's the luckiest moment I've had. And mine, I think, was winning when I was a kid, we had paper and pens back then, and I entered into a drawing for an autographed baseball at the local sporting goods place. And you write your name and phone number, drop it in the bin, and assume you're never going to win. I won. It was an Eric Davis autographed baseball. I think that was my greatest moment of luck.
Wow, Eric Davis, Cincinnati Reds, right?
Oh yeah, outfielder, 44. Had that great combination of speed and power that they so appreciate in the outfield.
Yeah, leadoff hitter too, wasn't he?
He was all over the place. A little more power and a little lower sometimes, but yeah. So I'm glad we've covered off on the really important stuff. Let's get back to talking about cornfield. No, let's get back to Tintree. So we haven't covered off on Tintree yet. So Tintree, in my experience, is one of the the League of Startups that came into being with hybrid offerings. Gosh, it's probably been, what, 6, 7, 8 years now, to go combat the incumbent legacies, the Dell, the EMC, IBM, HP before the split, with hybrid offerings. And if I recall, and I know this is before your time with Tintri, the best part of Tintri was performance with the flash, ease of use, and better cost profile than what the legacy providers had at the time. And you had Nimble and Tagile all in that same crew, and now you've all found your way into other larger companies. But that was back then. What's the differentiator today for Tintri?
The main differentiator, first of all, we go back, the first array came out over 10 years ago now. Hybrid's been close to 10 old. Years in 2010. I don't know exact date it came out, but it's been a while. So the big differentiator today and then is actually very similar. It's actually the file system. Unlike any other storage platform out there, which is some variant of ZFS, Tintri, we own the file system, meaning we control how the I/O is going in and out of it, which also allows us to do some granular things. Because also when we first launched it, we were not just a hybrid array, we were virtual aware storage. Because what happened is our founder was one of the lead engineers over at VMware and realized that storage for VMware is not what it needs to be. Legacy storage will not work for virtualization properly. We can mask a lot of things, but could never solve the problem. And so he started Tintri to go solve the problem of storage for virtualization, which basically means we changed the unit of measurement from a LUN/volume into a per VM so we can manage it and get you amazing things. And today still, we could do the best management per VM. We can show you which VM is using which IOPS, great visibility of every VM so you can quickly pinpoint problems. We have an auto QS feature, and based upon using machine learning, what your system does or what your VM is using, we can make sure you're guaranteed to get the same amount of IOPS in the future, so there's enough reserve. So one really busy VM does not slow down your VM, which is fantastic from a VDI perspective. And then also, since we own the file system, that we do cloning, we can clone for VDI faster than anybody else in the world. All right, go ahead. You had a question?
We've got a couple things there. So you started out as storage for VMware, which at the time, there wasn't a lot of specialty, right? There were a lot of arrays out there. Back then, it would have been your VNX and, there's all sorts of things rushing
Compelling
back.
Compelling had a bunch of things.
I feel old thinking about where I was at some of the product launches when that took place back then.
Your IBM SVCs, your Hitachi, your Power Arrays, all kinds of stuff.
But it's funny, though, because if you look at VMworld as an indicator and attending that show, it was not 2010, but maybe closer to 11, 12, where that really became an infrastructure show, and storage and switching and all these other things started to become really more important to the virtualization guys that really hadn't cared about it before. What do you attribute that to? Because you guys were there at the time and I'm sure you know the stories.
I may not mind. My first VMworld actually was 2014. And I don't remember, I wasn't part of I wasn't into the virtualization space. It was 2014 when I was a DBA and I started learning how to virtualize databases then, So that's where my focus was because in 2010, 2014 timeframe, I was just hard and heavy buying the biggest iron for my large SQL Server databases and understanding infrastructure from that perspective, not from a virtualization perspective. And so I haven't heard all the stories back from the guys who were at Tintri, guys to me is non-binary, it's not generic, not, it's gender specific. it's part of my lexicon and I have a hard time changing it, but guys refers to anybody.
I do the same thing. I do the same thing.
So anyway, back in the day, at Tintri, I don't know their stories of what did that, but from my perspective, of course, is, as virtualization took off, everybody needed to do it. We found out that virtualization does not introduce any problems into your infrastructure, but it highlights all the problems you have in your infrastructure that you didn't know because you were only using 5 or 10% of it. Now all of a sudden we're using 75 to 80% of it. Hey, it's a problem. We've always had it. We just didn't fix it. We just didn't know about it.
So go back to your role from a DBA perspective. So you were in the trenches. You were a SQL guy. You're doing that for not as a service provider, but for your company at that point, right?
Yeah. So in 2010, I was working for Cox Communications. Go ahead.
Okay. So when you think about SQL back then, you talked about the biggest iron you could throw at it. What was the biggest bottleneck back then for SQL Server?
Memory. Memory was slow. Actually, storage. Well, it's memory and storage. You basically to mask slower storage, because we're still talking back then, I was on the low-end EMC on this system. So what happened, of course, is I asked for storage. I basically asked for capacity, not for performance. And, you know, they gave me a RAID 5 group off of, you know, 12 disks. And I need the throughput to have it of like 128 disks. And, you know, I had to go out and spend a lot of budget money to go get a couple more shelves added to their, what was the base model? The CX40s, back in the EMC days, to go expand the system, sure. Add more shelves to get enough spinning disks to get the IOs, the throughput I needed to run the performance-wise. So the easier way for me was just to add a lot more memory and max out the memory of the box so I can keep everything in RAM instead of having to slow down and wait for my storage.
So what was your first experience personally with a box that had flash in it?
Fusion IO type flash kind of stuff was the first time I dealt with in putting some Fusion IO cards in, just to help speed along TempDB for SQL servers. You know, and the fun part, of course, is, you know, you spend that thousands of dollars for one, and then I go, no, we can't just have one. I got to have two, because I need redundancy, and they have a RAID 0 set. So if one dies, I can still operate, and then your manager freaks out on my new budget request.
You know, what's funny is I don't know if you stayed on that train long enough to get to Fusion IO's Ion platform, but I mean, for the longest time, they were by far the leaders in that space, not just from engineering an edge card. I mean, that was neat, but that wasn't their trick. It was the software and the rest of the stack that was pretty cool. So Ion was their software to take a bunch of Fusion IO cards and lump them together in a aggregated pool. We still run that today, and we still have, I think we still have 16 Fusion IO cards. And thankfully, since SanDisk acquired them and WD acquired SanDisk, no one remembers we have those, and probably at this point, nobody cares. But the last I looked, even maybe a year and a half ago, they were still maintaining that Ion code base. Which is pretty cool, but those cards have been dead reliable. I mean, just absolutely spectacular. And you as a SQL guy, they were one of the first to really start to have that conversation about tuning your application for your storage, because up to that point, there was no such thing really. Like you talked about adding shelves of hard drives, you could short stroke hard drives if you're running your own,
but
you didn't have many choices.
And then there's also, because Texas Memory Systems Violin came out the same time frame, and so trying to figure out which one of those three were the best, and you know, I like the Fusion IOs the best personally. I used a lot of those in a lot
TMS
of systems.
TMS was pretty cool.
Yeah.
TMS was a little more expensive though, I think, weren't they?
I think so too. You know, you're getting into the cobwebs of the brain.
I know. And we're recording this late. I've already had dinner and a couple of drinks, so this ought to be entertaining the rest of the way.
All right.
No, but that's great. So did you, as a customer, did you end up ever stepping into a hybrid or an all-flash array, did you move on to other things?
I moved from my life from Fortune 500 companies. I moved over to working for a consultancy firm. So I worked for House of Brick Technologies as a consultant, and there, every other week, I was visiting a new client trying to solve their today's problem usually around SQL Server infrastructure, HADR systems. So I saw the gamut. So just about every storage platform out there, I've seen some copy, including all kinds of build-your-own StarSAN, TASLASH, you know, JBOD type whatever on a Linux box that the local admin thought he was saving money on.
Yeah, until something happens.
Exactly. I mean, I saw some person actually manage to chain two Drobos and a QNAP into some sort of RAID 10 network SAN processor. I'm like, this is fantastic,
dear Lord.
But completely unsupportable. It was awesome, but no.
Yeah. Well, Drobo had that moment in time, and I guess they're trying to come back, but they had that moment in time where they had a big advantage because they were easy to use. And mm-hmm. so they had a pretty GUI. You dropped your hard drives in there. They had green lights light up on the GUI. And they even did a rack one where they had these ears you could attach to. I think it was the B800i, or maybe it was a 12-bay. I can't remember now. But it took half a rack. So some of these M&E use cases, video shops, were getting a full-size rack and having these things racked back-to-back, double-sided, all the cabling in the middle. But the ears weren't strong enough to hold the whole body up because they didn't go full length, and so they're all sagging in the middle. Oh, gosh. There's a... I've got a great story that's highly inappropriate, even for this podcast that has almost no rules. About a specific media and entertainment use case where they were doing this in Southern California, but that was not a good look, and I can't imagine cobbling together a couple of those and some NAS boxes together into some Franken storage.
Oh yeah, I've seen. But I tell you what, I mean, stuff.
You ask these IT admins to give you 10 terabytes or 50 terabytes or a petabyte and give them no money, and that's what happens, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, just the concept of it too, just as a horror story, not going to mention the SAN vendor, but the customer backed up all their SQL Server databases, you know, so they all ran on this on a basically single unit SAN. And of course, all the backups also went to the same single unit SAN. When the backplane went down, they asked me to come restore their databases to a different server. I'm like, but your database backups are on the same storage that's down. I can't get it off. And that's when they realized if the storage vendor can't solve their problem, they don't have a company anymore. Because they had no copies anywhere else of their data. Yeah. They didn't have any offsite. This is pre-cloud where you can dump things offsite. They didn't have Iron Mountain or any other tools like that. So they learned a lot from that perspective, and they were down for 3 days, but they finally got back up, and you know, they're still in business today, thankfully.
Well, so here's the thing that's troubling to me is that you had that story. We've all heard that story. Yeah. And we still hear that story every single day. Like, how is this happening? And you're saying, you know, back then there wasn't Veeam. There wasn't an easy, like, solution that was plug and play and you're good to go. And now there are, and we're still seeing big companies really mm-hmm. failing to account for backup and recovery. And maybe they've got it at the data center, but as IT distributes, and we talk so much about edge computing and you know, remote office, branch office, where these things aren't happening, and they're in environments where you should probably care as much or more, because there's no little to no IT staff out there, but they're still generating a lot of knowledge, a lot of IP. I mean, it's crazy to think that a basic, you know, 3-2-1 sort of backup strategy isn't taking place everywhere at this point. Like you said, right. Especially with the cloud, that makes it so much easier.
Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. I mean, to me, I run into situations, I've talked to customers on a regular basis still today, and sometimes they explain a story to you, and I'm like, how many bad decisions did you have to chain together to get into a situation that horrible?
You're reminding me of a funny story. Kevin and I were at a big, went up to Cleveland to go visit with a big customer from one of the large IT guys, and we're looking around their data center, and they were talking about how they were doing some geo cluster with another location across the street for disaster recovery. And I said, what's all the stuff on the shelf over there? And he's like, oh yeah, those are a bunch of tape cartridges for a thing that doesn't work anymore. I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know, tape's dead anyway. Right. And, making the joke, and he said, yeah, now we just back up to a USB 3 drive that I take home at night. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. It was one of those WD portable hard drives that was their backup target that went home with him every night. So yeah, big companies
did
doing
they have, did they have seven
things.
Of them so they can take one home, a different one home every night?
You would like to think so, but I think they were rotating two.
Okay. So yeah, so that's why, you know, one of the things about being a consultant is just all the fun stuff you see and just the horror stories of stuff, especially the, you know, just actually my old boss called me this week. Basically, she's having a problem with, they're trying to virtualize a SQL 2000 box doing a P2V concept. You know, I'm like, seriously, you have a physical 2000 box? That thing's been around for at least 20 years. It still runs. But yeah, now they have to P2V before it dies. Yes, you know, so they can still run the same application, but now we're making it virtual. I mean, just, again, repeating mistakes, and we're not solving the problem. We're just using cool technology to mask the issue.
Well, when did Microsoft even stop supporting 2000? I mean, that's been a while.
08, 09?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Brutal.
More than 10 years
ago.
Hard
to imagine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, for as easy as it is to dump that into a VM or, yeah, that's pretty crazy, an update. Oh, man. So we could sit here and go another half hour on horror stories, and that might be entertaining, actually. But I do want to give you a chance to come back to Tintri and talk about where Tintri is today. So last year, DDN, who's more known in the high-performance computing space and a couple other, not niche, but not necessarily mainstream enterprise areas. So Tintri comes in as the mid-market solution for DDN to push further down market. At least that's my take on it. How does Tintri sit in with the DDN portfolio today, and what does the overall company look like?
Sure. I can give the best perspective I can. I'm not actually probably the best person to answer this question. But so from a DDN perspective, it was close to 2 years ago when they picked up Tintri. And then we picked up, DDN also picked up Nexenthe Store, and then the Western Digital IntelliFlash, you know, division. And so we've now combined Nexenthe Store, IntelliFlash, and, you know, the traditional Tintri into one thing, as now we're just calling ourselves Tintri, but with all one product line, we're all one team, which is, we're now the enterprise arm for DDN, because DDN's focuses on the high-performance compute and massive storage systems. But the problem is a lot of their customers still need some sort of enterprise task storage. And so we're that arm for them, so we can go target all their enterprise customers. And we have over 10,000 enterprise customers now. So we are actually one of the largest storage companies out there. And DDN, of course, is the largest privately owned storage company in the world. And we're profitable, which is one of the most important keys for being a privately owned company. Unlike many other storage companies that aren't profitable.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of like losing money quarter over quarter and wondering why the stock price is falling. But, you know, whatever. To each their own.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, you know, Tintri, like I said, when we started, you know, back when they came out, the big pitch was this ease of use messaging. Is that still the case? I mean, I know the market's caught up some. We've got things like vRealize Operations and vVols now that make storage administration and provisioning and everything else through VMware a little easier. What's the current landscape and sort of reset us again on the Tintri pitch?
Sure. You know, in the days that, you know, we're still easier than even all that. I mean, vVols are fantastic. As a consultant, I loved vVols, except now I work for Tintri, the VMstore platform. Instead of setting up all my protocol endpoints and define all my service groups and all that extra steps you have to do to get vVols working, it's all baked into the system. It's already there. It's just two or three clicks away. So yes, vVols are good. Tintri VM Store has been doing it A, for a decade, and B, it's simpler and easier to operate. Plus, I don't have to worry about extra sets of metadata with the vVol concept to make sure I'm tracking and backing up, because it's not necessarily backed up properly from a, you know, vVol perspective always. Not to mention every vendor attacked vVols differently. So it comes down to the support concept. So if I'm using vVols and I change storage vendors, do I have to basically rebuild my entire vVol operations?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Okay. And so So because you guys were appealing more to the virtualization role in an org, is that still your main in, or is it really the storage arm? Like what's your typical engagement look like, and where are you engaging with a customer?
We still prefer to talk to the infrastructure admins and the directors, just mostly because sometimes storage admins don't like us because we take some other tasks that provide a lot of value, but we've made it simple so it's not that difficult to do anymore. I was having a virtual lunch with a customer yesterday, and he's like, I love Tentry. I can never imagine trying to carve up a LUN again and wasting all that time trying to map my storage out. You know, with the Tentry systems, and he's got 22 arrays now, I think. He says 95% of our storage tasks go away, so I don't have to worry about it. And they just run. They're kind of, except for patching and, from we have new versions of software come out, he really doesn't log into a lot of them on a regular basis. So they just run, which is great and scary at the same time, just because sometimes they forget, oh, hey, look, we got an alert. Yeah, it's still running. And he talked at the time he had 3 hard drives fail, and he kind of ignored it until he realized, hey, if I lose one more, the array goes down. And it's not that we had a bad system.
No, it
was he was so used to it running so well, he stopped doing all the proper management. And his biggest fear, of course, is if he, management decides, no, we want to go to a different storage vendor, is A, all this extra work he has to go do, how's he going to get it done? Or if he cheated, it's what he'll never want to change. He doesn't want to change jobs ever again. It's because he doesn't want to try to sell them on Tentry because he loves it so much. And most of our customers are in that boat. They are big fans of Tentry, and they don't want to change because they have to go back to doing a lot more work. And for us, what we talk to customers about is our system, intelligent infrastructure. It allows us to, we solve a lot of storage problems before they become actual problems. With the auto QoS feature and guaranteeing of resources, we don't have to worry. When there's not a problem, we have to go troubleshoot. There's not a, hey, everything is slow here, and go figure out what the bottleneck is and figure out one VM is using a ton of IO. We can spot that in seconds, but the auto QoS guarantees that the other VMs are still getting the amount of resources they need. So only the one VM is having a problem, not all the VMs on that one. And so this is why our customers really love us, is they can spot their problems and we prevent the problems from happening.
Yeah, the QoS one's interesting to me, and I'm a little surprised that we haven't seen more vendors hitting on that, because it must be harder to implement than I think, because I remember when SolidFire came out, like that was their thing, was QoS right. for service providers, software defined. Back then they were running on PowerEdge, but that was their big hook and their major differentiator. And that was 7 years ago or whatever. And right. we haven't really seen QoS continue to be enhanced, improved upon, talked about. And, we talk a lot about HCI and how that IO blender takes place because of a VM. You never know what's going to happen, and it's all a jumble of fun. Mm-hmm. But very few people are really talking about quality of service and how to protect. Really, what you're talking about is how to protect your other VMs from one getting nasty.
Well, the reason why no one wants to really talk about it is because they realize that the solution they provide will not be as robust as what we've been providing for the past 10 years. We've also got so many data points in the history of how this works because, going back to the system being purpose-built, we own the file system. It allows us to actually do QoS because we're managing at the file level, not at a file system level, which allows us to provide that QoS in there and do the measurements versus, I remember how SolidFire did it, but once NetApp purchased them, they kind of rolled it all into the data on tap OS process, and that QoS thing just became lower, and they did the QoS more at the volume level. So if I want to do the same kind of concept, I now have to carve up lots and lots of volumes and put just a couple of VMs per volume.
Okay. So you talked a little bit about hardware. How focused is Tentry on hardware versus the software? I mean, we're seeing we saw back in the day, you guys in these hybrid arrays come out, then the all-flash arrays, then the move to software-defined, and now we're seeing, it depends on who you talk to. We're either going to decouple everything or couple everything. What's your take on the value of hardware to the VM store product?
So, I mean, the hardware is tuned, our software is tuned for our hardware, which allows us to get the right amount of performance we can out of it. And so it's also, if you look at our sales process, we talked to you about how much performance-wise, because we talk more performance than capacity, even though you know, everyone talks about capacity of storage. You know, we're more about performance because most people tend to run out of performance before we run out of capacity these days. And so that's where we focus our thing, most of our focus on. And, you know, we don't like talking specs and hardware because we're not going to be the biggest and the fastest. You know, we're more about the experience because we want to make sure our customers are happy with the results, not, hey, I've got a Ferrari. The problem is I need to get 14 people to the airport. You know, my 15-passenger bus will get there, will solve that problem much faster, you know, instead of doing 15 trips to the Ferrari. You know, so that's what we want to do. We want to actually match the experience we have. I'm not saying we're slow like a van. I'm just saying
right. We're
trying to solve the problem from the experience level for what the IO is doing, not, you know, what's the fastest and greatest bell and whistle out there.
Well, I mean, for the mid-market down, though, we're kind of at the point where I don't want to say any flash array will get you what you need from a performance standpoint, but if we're not there yet, we're knocking on the door at least, right? Because, you know, we're talking about things like NVMe, the faster interconnect protocols, whether it's 25 gig or faster now. But we're not hearing, at least I'm not hearing, from a bulk of customers that are saying, well, geez, this flash array isn't fast enough. Because if it's not, then just like you guys, you know, can push them up to maybe a DDN product if that tier zero ultra high performance is what they need, then great, you've got an answer there, and most you know, most vendors will have an answer for that need. But it really seems to me that what we're talking about now is capabilities, ease of ownership and management, and all those sort of softer things that flash has really promised outside of just the performance profile for so long. So I mean, you're capitalizing at least on that trend for sure, I would say.
Right, and we're definitely, that's where we're at. We prefer to talk more about experience than anything else. You know, experience is, the end of the day is, it's a story I tell people. You know, there's a mansion near my house. It's massive, it's huge. You know what? Don't care what it costs, but just imagine if my cost to live there was $1,000 a month. Do I care if it costs $5 million or $100 million for that house? My cost is $1,000 a month kind of stuff. And my experience is going to be the same kind of thing. So same thing here is, I don't know how much the cost per se, but I want to talk about the experience. So as long as we're meeting the needs or defining the needs, it doesn't matter if I spent more or less kind of stuff, as long as we can figure out what the solution is. So now I've solved the problem. Solving the problem is more valuable than having bells and whistles. So let's figure out what the problem is, define the problem, and how our storage platform can resolve that for you. Then we'll figure out, you know, the cost price will just work itself out, because the value of having faster storage that doesn't solve my problem is still not all that great. You know, having the, you know, something that meets all my needs by experience, not to mention the other thing we talk about, intelligent infrastructure, allowing us to reduce the amount of admin tasks. Because you talk to most directors and, you know, C-level people, skills gap is one of the biggest issues we have now, not how fast the storage is. I can't find enough qualified people to run all my internal infrastructure applications. You know, my servers, my switches, my storage all together. If we can remove your overhead on that area so it's easier to manage, I don't need as many defined experts to do different things. I need more generalists. I can solve that skills gap easier.
So you're talking about, because I know you guys have some analytics, some ML, and then some other sort of tricks from the storage management and analytics standpoint. I don't know that we've talked to you guys about that, so I'm a little bit behind the curve on it. But you've got some sort of cloud-based analytics, right, that come with, I assume, all of the arrays at this point.
Correct. And, you know, so, Grant, you can opt out of it, but yes, it's, you know, we have cloud-based analytics for everything. And the cool thing about that, we have 14 trillion data points in there, which allows us to do some amazing big picture mapping. You know, for example, say you're going to go try to deploy Splunk in your organization. Well, you don't know how much resources it does and it needs. And based upon the size of your organization, we can make estimates for you to determine, hey, if you're going to deploy Splunk, the average mid-sized organization like you has this much compute, memory, and storage for their Splunk operation. And so we can share that information with them because we're anonymizing it from other customers as Splunk buckets. Sure. So we can say how many things have Splunk out there. You know, same thing for other applications. We can help do that. Plus, of course, with the analytics, we can trend your capacity performance IOPS per virtual machine, see what your outliers are really quickly, too, to figure out are those normal outliers or are they actually something else is going wrong, but then allow us to trend going losing back the last past 18 months or past 3 years to forecast forward 18 months to see when you're going to run out of storage space or capacity, you know, from a performance perspective, you know, and we can look at things very granular or very big picture, which is fantastic. And also with our new feature, the SQL integrated storage, just allows us to do the same thing for databases too, because right now most DBAs don't have a concept of how much performance their database is using. They just know what the capacity is used.
All right, well, let's talk about that. So the SQL integrated storage announcement was this week. We wrote about it, of course, and you gave us a demo of that product. And you, being a former SQL DBA, so this must hit very near and dear to your heart. So tell us a little bit more about that integration and what you're doing there, because this is much more than just, you know, being SQL ready or whatever sort of the softer version of this is.
Correct. And so actually that's kind of why I was actually brought on board to be with Tentry, is I've had a relationship with Tentry for the past 6 years, speaking at VMworld with them, you know, on different SQL Server topics. But they needed a DBA to help to guide them through the process of SQL integrated storage. And since they knew me and we had a great relationship, you know, they brought me on board. So short version of what SQL integrated storage is we're going to change how we manage storage for SQL Server databases. So the short version is, again, we're changing how you manage SQL Server databases. So we're going to let you start looking at it per database, no longer looking at it as a LUN process. So now I can go look at my performance per database, so figure out how much IOPS every single database is using, how much it needs, and then also using the auto QoS feature to give my QoS per database, which allows me to guarantee performance for all my databases. Because today, I dump 10, 12, 15 databases on a single SQL Server. It's a VM. I dumped that on a LUN with five other SQL servers. I now have 75 databases on one LUN. One SQL Server database has a bad query due to developing issues, a business analyst writing a horrible query, whatever reason. One bad query will take up all the I/O for that LUN, and all other 74 applications now suffer because of that. With SQL integrated storage, the auto QoS feature we're talking about now comes into play, and we can QoS and provide all 74 databases the right amount of IOs or guarantee the amount of performance for them while slowing down that one bad query process. Or that basically they still get to go faster, but they don't get to take all the resources. They only get to take most of the resources, which is fantastic, because now we don't have those, it's slow, how do I fault solve it?
So are you setting minimums and or maximums? Because I'm thinking about it too from the other way, is if we're using this for a lot of DevOps and that sort of thing, I'm not sure I want some rogue development task that's working against maybe a snap or some other copy of this database to start now consuming resources on a production box that it doesn't need to.
So by default, we don't set any max or mins. You can go in there and set them per database if you want to, or use like service group processes so we can batch it together and set limitations on it. So we have, you know, by whatever process we want to do for that. The auto QoS feature, which is one of those fantastic things, is it automatically looks at the resources it's been using and guarantees you enough reserves, enough of the cache, enough of this thing process inside of the storage processors to make sure we meet your I/O needs based upon your historical performance. So if I've been running and then some developer starts cranking things out, yes, they're going to use more resources, but I'm still reserving enough resources for you to continue your historical trend patterns. Now, granted, as that developer has been cranking out things and it's nonstop, always running, the trend patterns will now give more and more resources to that one date, you know, the bad database, for example. So yes, you can definitely use your QoS function for that. And my favorite thing about the QoS function is more of, I don't want to talk about too many vendors, but SolarWinds, for example, with their Orion database, and like McAfee with their EPO database. They're great products, but their databases are very, very chatty, meaning they do a lot of I/O all the time, all day, every day. And so customers have always, from a SQL Server perspective, you've either put them on a separate SQL Server just because they don't want it impacting other ones, or they use this thing called Resource Governor in SQL Server, which is a cool feature, but it's kind of hard to implement kind of feature. And now with auto QoS or with the QoS settings, I can go ahead and just set a QoS for that and slow down that one database. Or if it's an important database, I can go ahead and speed up that database so I can go faster with it automatically.
Huh. Okay. That's pretty slick. So when you think about something like SQL integrated storage, is we're talking about again in the broader context of how you build out meaningful features, because you've got snaps, you've got replication, you've got things like that already that have kind of been baseline for a while now. Is this the future, deeper app integration? And if so, is there anything you can talk about in terms of future development for Tintri and other things you guys are thinking about?
Sure. I mean, in the day is we're changing, basically the whole VM store platform from start day one, purpose built for virtualization, because we designed it around the VM as the unit of measurement, so to speak. And so now we expanded the platform. And once we changed the platform to allow us to do a new thing not besides virtual machines, i.e. SQL Server databases, we've had to change a lot of the code base to handle other objects. So now we're in this space of what other objects to tackle. And so I can't go into the specifics of what we're working on because there's lots of different things, but anything that needs a lower level management or level of integration and visibility from a storage perspective, anything new technology-wise, and I mean, I can basically mention containers. I can't say I can't say where the roadmap is at and how close we are on it, but obviously it is a massive trend in the industry. Obviously your short-term containers that come up, go down, disappear, don't really care so much about those, but the ones where are going to persist, having better visibility and better management tools for those obviously is something that makes sense for us to care about.
Yeah, well, and that's all the rage. If you look at attendance of KubeCon over the last 5 years, it's gone from a couple guys in a broom closet to I think 12,000 last year. Unbelievable the yep. growth in that segment.
And it's grown so much finally that we're running into problems where we're going to have performance issues because of the size and scale we're talking about. When someone is talking about basically using Docker with 100 containers, I could run it inside of a VM and I didn't think twice about it. Now, of course, vSphere 7, it's fully container aware, and they're actually managing it from that perspective. So now we have a lot more storage concerns and infrastructure, especially as we get the size and scale of large environments of having hundreds, if not thousands, of containers, and how do we manage that at a per-container level? And guess who has a storage platform that's probably best suited for doing something like that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point, the way you're talking about it, the way you guys are thinking about it. And the other thing I think that's going to be important is the analytics piece, right? Because those environments tend to be more dynamic and a tad less predictable than some database that's growing at X percent a year. And I know I'm going to need to add 5 terabytes or 10, whatever the number is over time. A lot of enterprise environments are very predictable in their growth. And I'm not sure the same case is true as we're looking at the containers and the concept of more in-house app development and things along those lines.
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah. That'll be really interesting. Okay. Do you think that with the advancements that VMware's engaged in, Tanzu with the containers, and then we talked a little bit about vVols. Concerned is probably the wrong word, but do you think the control plane for storage still stays with the array, or do you think that some of that shifts? And if it does, what do you guys have to do to be well positioned for that?
It's a good question, and I probably haven't spent as much time thinking about that as others have, so I'm probably going to pass on that kind of question. Yeah. I know there's a lot of concepts on that. And the cool thing, before I talked about it, everybody, we have a full REST API. Our UI uses our REST to get in to do things. So, do we move that, allow others to access our API? Yes. So third parties can already integrate with us, especially, back on, talking about SQL integrated storage again, DevOps tools, CI/CD tools, having those things, your Jenkins, your Ansibles, your whatever you want to, connect to our systems, to clone VMs, to clone databases, to spin up their dev environment so they can get through rapid cycle testing. You know, I was talking to somebody who's a customer recently, and they're using Jenkins and Ansible to automate all their QA regression testing in cycles, and things that used to take them weeks to get through now takes them hours to get through because they can basically clone the database and the VM. So create the application pool, web server, blah, blah, in this isolated environment, run through its tests, break it down, and start over again. And the cool thing about it is when they're starting back over, they're starting back over at a known steady state instead of starting back over in a, we've made these other modifications, it's not a known steady state again. But they can go through hundreds and hundreds of tests in a day, which used to take, they might be able to do 10 or 15 a day. And so they're just floored by the speed of automation. You know, even though they never log into our storage platform, complain, the storage admins or infrastructure admins still have to log in just to make sure it's healthy, trending analysis, making sure big picture kind of stuff. But they've offloaded all the storage tasks onto the development team who's integrating with the system. And the Ansible and Jenkins are basically doing most of the commands to the system. No one's logging in to go make a clone. It's all through their APIs.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And that's definitely the next wave in terms of interaction. So,
And I tell people this is allows you, the infrastructure team, to get out of the way of innovation. Because, you know, I've worked in infrastructure, you know, there's always tickets to go solve. Well, if I can take the unit of work to give it to the person, you know, to the person who wants to consume the unit of work more for, you know, and make it fast and operational. Hey, I don't want to do it. I don't want the ticket to management wise. And now it's on your plate to go do. You do it when you want it. And it's basically self-service, but it's, to me, it's a lot more than self-service because it's not, you know, we're not giving them the pie in the sky. We're just allowing them to do their work without having to wait for others to help them along.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're talking about efficiencies and improved processes at that point where, mm-hmm. where, you know, I don't want to categorize all the storage admins as bumps in the road, but you smooth out some of that that process and just make it easier, faster, simpler, and mm-hmm. and then you can worry more about your infrastructure capabilities and your backups and
right.
I mean, and let apps guys go do their thing.
Yeah, because you don't ever meet a storage admin who's like, oh yeah, I got so much free time in my hands. You know, they're all, you know, the problem is they're fighting so many small fires and doing mundane tasks day to day. They don't take the step back to do big picture planning, the big picture process to make sure HADR systems are in place or tested. You know, once that's going to be failed over to something to make sure it works properly kind of stuff. And those things, because we don't have the time, we're always fighting today's fire. And so now if I can remove a lot of those simple storage tasks and mundane tasks off to the developers and teach the developers what's possible. Sometimes the developers don't even understand this cool technology even exists. So we have to teach them. And now we're part of the innovation process for the organization. And we're driving the organization forward from a storage perspective instead of being the ones that they're asking for innovation. I can't provide it. We can now turn around and provide innovation and allow them to drive the company faster.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It's fun to listen to you talk about, you know, where you are and where you're going, because for a company that's 10 years old, you're still sounding startup-y in terms of your, you know, looking for differentiation points in terms of your positioning and flexibility and capabilities and just the way you talk about the product, which is probably not the worst mentality to have, you know, always looking for spots to innovate and be a little different.
Yeah, and it's just in the days we want to be relevant to our customers and provide solutions to today's problems. And a lot of times we spend more of our time thinking about what are the problems that exist that we actually don't talk about or may not even recognize. As mentioned, storage admins, they're fully busy. Infrastructure admins, they're fully busy. The DBAs, you know, nobody has extra DBAs laying around. They're all fully optimized and fully utilized. But the problem is they're all doing not high payoff tasks a lot of times. So now we need to get them to think more strategically and tactically, or stop doing tactically, think strategically. And how do you basically provide a better experience for them to allow them to get into the tactical, into the strategic roles that drive the most value for these organizations? And that's where we're focused on.
Well, makes sense. So just as a reminder, the SQL integration, you guys announced that this week. Is that available now? Is that in, yes, in the latest build?
Yeah, it went GA on Tuesday, and by Wednesday we already had 18 customers. You know, had downloaded, upgraded. There's, you know, because you need to obviously do a software upgrade to their arrays. Had updated their arrays. You know, and started asking questions about different processes and how to make it, how to optimize it. So we are fantastically happy about the reception. You know, we've had multiple customers who have been waiting over a year because they knew this was coming to change their SQL Server architecture to help them, because they want this to revolutionize how they manage their SQL servers, and they've been trying to pushing things off. You know, once they did the SQL Server 2008 upgrade, because that went out of support, they waited to help us help them architect their next solution, because now we're going to convince them to change how they manage things, and working with their DBAs, working with the infrastructure admins to provide more value, less manual tasks, and more automation, you know, more machine learning processes to help things run better, smoother. And so again, at the end of the day, the DBA, the developers, and the infrastructure admins can spend more time on strategic thinking, not tactical tasks.
So this was available in your standard update process. Is there an additional license or cost required to enable this feature?
Not necessarily. So, you know, so we have this thing called TGC, which is Tentry Global Center. And, you know, most of our customers have either the software suite or TGC Advanced, which is basically means you have all the replication features, this kind of stuff. So if you happen to just have a base license, you couldn't do replication, you couldn't do that kind of stuff. So you had kind of a very limited array. You didn't have it. You don't have SQL integrated storage. But most of our customers have all those replication features and all those things, which is the TGC Advanced license. And so, yes, for those customers, it's just part of the bundle. There's no extra fee for it. So the vast majority of customers are already there.
Okay, cool. So for those that want to learn more about it, you can check out Tintri.com, Tintri.com. And if you go over to Solutions on the dropdown, there's a SQL integrated storage page. So there's more goodies there. Well, this is great. You know, Sean, really appreciate you joining for the podcast today. Glad to have you on. And you know, I think that for those that are your customers, they'll be glad to hear about SQL and all these great things that you guys are doing. And for those that aren't, you know, maybe they'll give you guys another look. So thanks for joining in. Really appreciate it.
Sure. One last comment. Tentry.com/SQL is the landing page for all the SQL integrated storage. So all of our content goes there first. So if you want, you know, all our other cool stuff for VDI and storage in general, virtual machines and stuff, yes. But you know, if you want to talk about more SQL, /SQL gets you to our SQL Server landing page.
Sweet. All right. Awesome. Good link update. Appreciate that. And again, thanks for the time.
No, thank you for having me.
I want to thank Sean again for participating in the podcast. That's our first ever with Tintri, so that was fun, and hopefully much more to come from them. I'm really interested to see what happens with their container story. I think that's going to be an important part of their continued growth. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend, give it a thumbs up on iTunes or Stitcher or Spotify or whatever you're listening to it on. Leave a review. We really appreciate the feedback. You can hit us anytime, info@storageview.com. If you want a direct lifeline to the team, let us know what you think, what we could be doing better, especially if it's in regards to Kevin organizing the lab a little more cleanly. Also, our subreddit's growing. We're up over 3,200 now there, so feel free to join in the conversation there, reddit.com/r/storagereview. And Lucy's got all of our social media jamming. We're creating special content for Instagram and Twitter and LinkedIn and all of those other places. So follow us wherever you want. Follow us everywhere. We really appreciate the support. Thanks, and we'll be back next week with another podcast.